Good morning. What will Hawaii look like in 30 years? And what kind of education system will we need soon to support those needs? That's part of what World Watch Institute scholar Eric Asadorian considers. He joins us to talk about sustainability and cultural transformation. I'm Beth Ann Koslovich.
And I'm Chris Vandercook. Hawaii has become one of the world's major coffee-growing regions, and Sean Steinman, author of the Hawaii Coffee Book, A Gourmet's Guide from Kona to Kauai, is with us to explain why. And it's one thing to have a hit record, but it's quite another to generate hit songs down through the decades, as Air Supply has done. We'll hear from songwriter and guitarist Graham Russell.
That's the conversation for this Thursday, October 13th, day two of the Fall Pledge Drive. Now the news.
Was in another lifetime, one of toil and blood, when blackness was a virtue, the road was full of mud. I came in from the wilderness, a creature void of form. Come in, she said, I'll give you shelter from the storm.
Good morning and welcome to The Conversation. Good morning, Beth Ann.
Good morning, and a little Bob Dylan.
Yeah.
As he's just won the Nobel Prize.
I was tempted to say good morning, Beth Ann.
Well, you just did.
I guess so.
Well, good morning indeed in whatever voice. And we're going to move along and talk about something that you may think about a whole lot these days. Maybe not. You don't need us to tell us, though, that life is changing. How the public education system, though, is rising to those challenges, at least in the conversation that most of us hear, usually involves those more general statements about sustainability and meeting 21st needs. Eric Asadorian sees more of an immediate and specific shift that has the power to move the education system from a conduit of individual success to one of cultural change. He is a senior fellow at the Washington, D.C.-based World Watch Institute. He's in Hawaii this week and with us this morning. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
We have been learning that so many systems that we have seen in past as being independent really have so much cross connections that we have to look at it far more holistically. That's sort of been sort of the conversation surrounding sustainability in general. But that starts very early. And while you're not an education reformist, your point seems to be that we really need to look at it from that point at the various early ages and then see how that's going to play into the learning that's going to be able to meet those needs that may be yet as undiscovered as we're constantly told. How do we do that if we don't really understand, you know, what Hawaii may look like in, say, in 40 or 50 years?
Well, I think we have to start from that place of what is Hawaii going to look like. We don't know exactly what it's going to look like, but the trends are pretty much locked in, at least to some level. We're going to have a global population of about 9.9 billion people, probably about 2.3 degrees Celsius of temperature change already halfway through the century, on track to maybe 4 degrees unless we do some miraculous changes with policy around fossil fuels. So we can start asking ourselves, are we really going to have an economy like the one today? Is a service economy based on tourism realistic when either the world's governments have reined in carbon emissions or the more likely scenario that systems have broken down to one degree or another and there's lots of refugees and political crises and all of that? So if that's the future that we can see, and we can when we're honest about where the future is going, then we have to ask a whole different set of questions of what do our children need to learn? And that's the project that I'm working on, is trying to really look at what Earth-centric education should look like in the 21st century.
From what you have seen and heard, is Hawaii being honest about its future and the way that we regard our tourism industry and what we see as being the base of our economy?
I would love to turn that question to you. I mean, what I have seen or what I can see about all of the world, not just Hawaii, is that there's a level of denial that's built in. We have to, because the idea, I mean, if you actually look at the at what needs to change, it's our entire consumer economy. There's a great example from of a report, State of the World 2013, where we looked at what One Planet Living looks like. And what it looks like, even just in a population of 7.1 billion, which was the population at the time, let alone the 9.9 billion coming, we're talking about a pretty much meat-free diet. We're talking about minimal flying. So you all are locked into this island at that point. We're talking about a pet-free future. We're talking about you know, very small homes and almost no private car ownership. That's the level of change that has to happen in order to stop undermining climate stability and all the other ecosystems that we've been degrading. And that's impossible not to deny. I mean, to not be in a state of denial because...
Or shock, both.
So it's not easy to really imagine how we get over that hump. But building into education now strategies so children can be prepared for that and be prepared for what? No one knows exactly. But teaching critical thinking, systems thinking, building connections to the earth that we have lost now. Well, you know, most children spend 20 minutes a day outside at the most and something like 8 to 9 hours in front of screens.
So at least you know, here, but in other places in the world, that's not so.
In perhaps in developing countries, but even in Europe, it's very few places other than the exceptions, I think, where there's a really great trend now towards forest schools, where especially in Europe, I mean, there are over 1,000 in Germany, for example, that children spend their first 2 years, their preschool years, in the woods. Right? There's no school. It's just you go to the woods every morning and you spend 5 to 6 hours a day playing in the woods. And the research is showing, this has been the fun part of, I have a four-year-old, so learning all about education over these past few years has been helpful for me. But the research really shows that academic learning at 4, 5, 6 is not useful. Playing is useful. Playing increases mental health. It increases long-term learning and development in that sense. So putting children in a preschool to start teaching the alphabet at 4 and 5 is not helpful. Long-term, it's disrupting the kind of natural ability to play and connect with nature and all of that. And it's not improving even academic outputs in the end.
We have some charter schools where that is a part of the day. And you're saying, really, this should be the basis of it, to be able to go outside, to be able to be in direct contact with the culture that is here in many different forms, with nature, with what we have to offer, but also get used to the idea that we are going to have to make our world very much where we are, and we're going back to a very local idea as opposed to this global traveler idea.
Absolutely. So reconnecting children to nature, I mean, it can have those sustainability benefits where kids get the reason why we need to do all this.
And specifically here, being able to develop a much more agrarian culture.
Absolutely. And the other piece of this puzzle, as you're embedded in a natural setting, you're starting to learn those life skills that will become more and more valuable. One day, not too long into the future, Hawaii is going to be an agrarian society once again.
And not necessarily the tourist-based area that we think we are now.
No, probably not.
Eric Asadorian, thank you so much for coming in. Wish we had more time.
My pleasure, Bethann.
Eric Asadorian is a senior fellow at the World Watch Institute in Washington, D.C., and directs their Transforming Cultures projects. It focuses on how we transform cultures so that living sustainably feels as natural as living as a consumer feels today. He'll be speaking at UH Manoa's Architecture Auditorium tonight at 5:30. He'll also discuss is sustainability still possible at the Church of the Crossroads on Saturday. The details are on our Facebook page, Hawaii Conversation.
You're back with the conversation on HPR2. And given the time of the day, it's likely that coffee is on the mind of many people out there. It's unlikely that many, though, are thinking about coffee in as much detail as Sean Steinman. Sean is the author of the Hawaii Coffee Book, a gourmet's guide from Kona to Kauai, and we look ahead to this year's Coffee Fest. He's joining us in our studio. Good morning, Sean.
Good morning, Chris. How are you?
Pretty good, and I'm sort of a good blank slate for you to draw upon because I'm not a coffee drinker, and I'm mystified by how complex the world of coffee can be.
It can be as simple as a cup of coffee. It can be as deep and complex and fun as you want it to be also.
Well, you've chosen to make it complex and fun, right?
That's sort of how my life worked out.
And you sort of came at it from the science angle, which is kind of interesting. But people don't think of it, I don't think of it that necessarily as a science.
You know, I moved to Hawaii to avoid life a little bit. I didn't know what I was going to do when I left undergrad. And
we
I
have
thought,
it here, too.
Right? I thought I would just stay in school for a while. So I moved here to study coffee and as a scientist, and it worked out really well. And it was fun and interesting. And ever since I've approached coffee from this scientific perspective.
What do you think drew you to it? And what was fun and interesting about it?
Well, I always loved coffee from a very young age. Mm-hmm. And I always loved science from a very young age. And it was just two hobbies in life that fit together in school and kept fitting together. It was really totally unintentional.
anything that deals with taste and people's taste is going to be so subjective that you can't really quantify much about it, right?
Oh, it sounds like a fun thing to say, but it's not that simple, right? Let's talk about complexity.
Yeah.
From a simple way, what you like and what I like is different, and
right.
That's okay. We're all allowed to be subjective. We're all allowed to engage in our own realities.
Mm-hmm.
And for most of like and dislike, that's all there is. But there's no reason we can't teach a person to be a better instrument, to be able to talk about something based on what it is versus what they like about it.
Mm-hmm.
And there is an entire field of sensory science that does this, that tries to look at foods and drinks from this perspective of instrumentation. And there's this beautiful set of literature that shows all kinds of cool things about how the lights in the room or the colors or the sounds or the feels of dishes or the colors of dishes all influence our perception of taste, which means that, all the time when we're consuming something, we're influenced by this. So there is a huge subjectivity about how we like something and how we perceive it, but it can be understood a little bit. It can be controlled a little bit. And we can start to talk about the objective quality of something at some point, once we define it and once we approach it, once we start measuring it in mm-hmm. a more objective way.
I've heard a lot of food people talk about presentation, how the food is brought to you, how it's put on the plate, how it's placed, what else is on the plate with it, that kind of thing. There's a coffee equivalent to that, I would think.
A little bit. Certainly with modern espresso drinks, there's a way to really doll up the cappuccinos and the lattes with using the milk and the coffee and blending the colors together.
Mm-hmm.
But, a cup of coffee is a cup of coffee. You could obviously change the cup it's in, but you're not going to be adding flowers and sauces. And there's a limitation, I think. Now,
yeah.
I could be wrong. Maybe there's some cafe in Sweden somewhere that's totally doing this other thing that I don't know about. But
in the Hawaii coffee world, as you say, from Kona to Kauai, that's a lot of variation in flavor, right?
Absolutely.
What brings those variations about?
There's the varieties people use. There's the place it's grown in. There's the way it's grown, the way it's processed, how old it is after it's been picked and gets to you, how it's roasted, how it's brewed. It's actually a lot of stuff that can go on. It's surprising.
What are the variations in, say, the way it's grown?
Coffee's a plant like anything else. It needs food and water, and it needs a certain amount to be as productive as you want it to be.
Right.
You can give it as much as it wants. You can give it less than it wants. Maybe you choose to live in a place where you're limited by rainfall and you don't irrigate, so the potential of the plant to get as much as it needs might be limited by Mother Nature.
Mm-hmm.
So there's just the basic, I'm a farmer and I have to do these farming things. But there's also when you choose to address certain problems that may or may not exist. Well, if there are problems, they exist, and you need to address them. It could be when you choose to harvest, how you choose to harvest. Are you feeding it enough? If we assume that the plant needs a certain amount of food, and if it gets it, it's happy. And if it doesn't, maybe something's not quite right.
Mm-hmm.
There's very little understanding, actually, about specific things that influence the taste of a cup of coffee. but there's lots of indications of things that might be happening.
Well, let's say you did a blind taste test and you found a flavor of coffee and said, this is it for me. And just based on that taste only, could you then set out to grow that coffee?
That's a spectacular question. I'm going to say maybe. Because there's so many things. But, you know, one of the things we forget about as non-scientists is that there's always an interaction between a living thing and its place. Mm-hmm. So let's say I found this coffee on this farm somewhere that was amazing, as you describe it. And I find out its genetics, you know, whatever variety or species it is. So I take that and I plant it somewhere else.
Yeah.
It's going to be similar, but there's going to be differences because of how the thing interacts with the place and mm-hmm. the time and the environment. You can't control that. So it makes it hard to predict. Certainly, you can take something that you really like and grow it different places, and that will help.
Yeah.
But you're not guaranteed to replicate it. And, you know, personally, I think that black box of what's going on, it's really fun.
Even with all that science, though, you really couldn't. It would still be a little bit of a crapshoot.
Yeah. And part of it is because with coffee science, it's the, you know, coffee science has been around for a while, but for doing different things than we want it to do today. So mm-hmm. today, we really want to understand taste and all these things that go into it so we can manipulate it and reproduce it and move it around the world. But this is all very new way of thinking about it. So the research is all just very new and mm-hmm. and young, almost naive in some regards. Whereas 30 years ago, we were worried about disease and production. So we have all this history. It's coffee science, but it's been doing different things, which is fine. But we now need to ask new questions and start to get new answers.
30 years ago, we were just looking to see how much we could grow, and it was sort of a more generic approach to what it is, less detailed about the different strains of coffee?
A little bit more generic. You know, the history of agricultural science is not really that old. We've obviously been doing agriculture for a long time, but in terms of modern science where we have statistics and we have, you know, creating experiments with agriculture is about a century old. So with coffee, it's, you know, just as old as everything else. And we've just had to do all the basic stuff first. And we're now well past that. We're still basic questions to ask, but now we can ask fun things, and that's what we're starting to do.
Well, Sean, I'm sort of glad to know there's a little bit of mystery left to it.
You and me alike.
Thanks very much for coming.
My pleasure.
With us on the show. Sean Steinman is the author of the Hawaii Coffee Book, A Gourmet's Guide from Kona to Kauai. And this year's Hawaii Coffee Fest runs 8 a.m. until noon Saturday at the Kaka'ako Farmers Market.
Support for The Conversation comes from Bank of Hawaii Private Banking, where a personal relationship manager and financial services team provide custom solutions. Learn more about Bank of Hawaii Private Banking at boh.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC.
Umurokai, Ulanai, Umau, Ukaholabe, Ohavai.
A little sad news. I'm told we're all out of love in today's backyard quiz. Fortunately, Graham Russell of Air Supply is going to help us out a little later in the show, so don't be worried. In honor of their return to Hawaii, today's quiz concerns that popular 80s rock duo. The core group of Russell Hitchcock and Graham Russell formed as Air Supply in Melbourne, Australia, around 1975. By the 1980s, Air Supply had achieved worldwide fame, releasing several chart-topping albums and singles. At the height of their popularity, Air Supply released a live concert video set right here in Hawaii. If you can be the first to tell us what year that show took place and at which venue, you'll be today's winner, and you'll get the T-shirt. Our number is 941-3689 or 877-941-3689.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Pacific Buddhist Academy, a high school dedicated to peace education and student-centered learning. Open house October 19th at 5:30 p.m. PacificBuddhistAcademy.org.
If you listen to this program on a daily basis, you know that many of the stories show up in our reality checks with Civil Beat. Today, Civil Beat is taking a new tact in considering some of our reality in Hawaii. It's launching a podcast. Chad Blair joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
This seems to really prove the point, as we've talked about many times, that Hawaii isn't always a paradise.
No, and I should tell you that it's an old subject with a new take. The famous Massey case of 1932. You remember the death of a Native Hawaiian man at the hands of a naval officer's wife. It was an enormously controversial issue. And we've tied that to the Christopher Deedy case, the trial for killing Colin Eldredge here in 2011 during the APEC conference. We believe the two cases reflect ethnic unrest, how it plays out here in the islands, power plays in general. And it's all part of our brand new podcast series. We're calling it Offshore, and we launched it just today.
I heard the first episode, and it really makes a lot of those points, but it also leaves some to your imagination, or at least some for successive episodes.
You know, and it's a 10-episode series, by the way. That's the wonderful thing about podcasts. I mean, you're in the radio business. We're in the print business. Now we're trying to branch out into sort of a hybrid, if you will, that hoping folks will listen to us. It's really amazing how podcasts have caught on for so many people. Statistics show that I think it's something like 40% in the U.S. that they listen to podcasts. And maybe they're doing it while they're exercising or doing chores around the house, just like they do listening to HBR. So we're hoping that HBR listeners will listen to Civil Beat and its podcast. Future series are going to be looking at things like, the clash of science and culture on Mauna Kea, the telescopes, something that HBR has reported on quite a lot. We're also going to be looking at the difficulties in trying to have a sustainable food supply, something we've talked about for a long time. But as you know, we import so much of our food.
Well, good luck with it. As I said, the episode one is really good, and I wish you much success with that.
Thanks. You can listen on iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play.
Download it on our website.
Thanks, Beth Ann.
You're welcome. Thanks, Chad. Chad Blair joins us every day with a reality check.
Before we hear from Graham Russell himself, we have today's backyard quiz answer. And we asked you for the year and the venue in which Air Supply filmed a live concert video here in Hawaii. The Australian duo is best known for ballads such as All Out of Love, Making Love Out of Nothing. They formed in 1975 and began to get serious attention in the U.S. by the 80s and started touring internationally. In line with the times, Air Supply decided to make a music video, and they opted to go big, filming an entire live concert here in Hawaii. The year was 1983. The venue was the Neil S. Blaisdell Center, and the film itself was released in 1984. That's today's quiz, and we didn't get any winners on that today, but if you've got a quiz for us, you'd like to share something about our backyard, send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from the College of Business at Hawaii Pacific University, whose MBA Flex Plus program offers a blend of classroom and online classes to fit the lives of working professionals. hpu.edu/business.
The Australian duo Air Supply, Graham Russell and Russell Hitchcock, has achieved what very few accomplish in the music industry, popular success that endures over the decades. So many careers flame out as quickly as they began, but theirs has continued even as their audiences grow up and grow old. We talked with the guitar playing and songwriting half of the duo, Graham Russell, about the phenomenon.
It seems that once people hook onto our music, they're there for a lifetime, it seems. So is very fortunate. We're very fortunate with that. But we've never veered from what we want to do, you know.
And it probably would have been a mistake, don't you think, to try to adapt?
I do, yeah. I mean, you know, in the way, way back in the 80s, people, you know, when we were the ballad kings of the world, and probably still are, I'm sure, people would say, oh, well, why do you always put ballads out? But it wasn't our decision, it was the record companies. However, we're glad that they did that now, because that's what we love. And, you know, people would sometimes say, oh, why don't you do a rockier song, which we did on our albums. But we'd say, hey, but get the album and have a listen. It's not all ballads, you know. But we, once again, we've always done what we believe was right for us, you know.
In a way, what I hear, Graham, is it is a testament to the power of melody.
I couldn't agree more. I just love melodies, you know. And growing up with, you know, when I grew up, you know, I was born in 1950, so from 50 to 60, I used to listen to the BBC radio growing up in England, mm-hmm. and it was all like Elvis, Frank Sinatra, and all those kind of real classic songs and classic singers, and my parents and my sisters would play them all the time, and so that would soak into my subconscious. So by the time I was like 13 or 14, the Beatles had arrived, and there was another barrage of the greatest melodies in the world. So I have that in my brain right before I started to write songs. So melody for me was just the only way to go. You know, it's funny because if I listen to a new song of any kind, and I listen to a lot of things, if there's no melody there, my mind just wanders and I'm gone.
Yeah.
I just love melody, you know, deeply.
Graham, a songwriter friend of mine, I once asked him how he knew if he had a good song, and he said, if I can sing it without accompaniment and clap my hands and it still holds together, I've got a song. Do you agree?
I really do agree. I'm a big believer that, you know, in the studio, you can have all kinds of tricks these days, but you can get a song and just sing it to someone, even without any guitar or piano accompaniment, and something happens to them, then it's a great song. I've always thought that. A song has to stand up on its own two feet, you know, without other instruments. You know, you've got to be able to just play it to someone without saying, oh, I need the piano, I need this. Just do it. And if it's a great song, that person will tell you. And you'll already know anyway, you know.
It can be tempting, though, especially when you know, develop instrumental skills, to sort of surround it with all kinds of other stuff, don't you think?
It is very tempting, but we always try to keep our records really basic and simple, because that's who we are. We're very simple people, and very emotionally driven, and so consequently very melody-driven. And you don't need a lot of things around a melody. The less you have around it, the better. I mean, when anyone listens to the early Beatles recordings, there's nothing there except that those beautiful melodies. And that's what I always go back to, you know, and I go, okay, now I remember what they did and what happened, you know.
With your own songs, Graham, that you've performed now, I'm sure, thousands and thousands of times, You have to bring a sense of freshness to the audience, because they haven't heard them thousands and thousands of times. At least they haven't heard you sing them live that way. How do you do that?
Yes. Well, we change it up a little. Like, for instance, we might do an acoustic version of Lost in Love. It might just be Russell, myself, and the guitar. Mm-hmm. Or with Sweet Dreams, we may put an orchestral arrangement in the middle of the song. In fact, right now we're doing two Less Lonely People with just Russell and myself and a guitar. But we swap it up, you know. And plus, we have people come in and out of the band. You know, they come in, stay for 5 or 6 years or 10 years or 15 years, and they bring their flavor too. And we count on that. When someone comes into the band, you know, we don't tell them what to play. We say, listen to the songs and then play what you think you should play. And usually it's something a little different. But that small difference creates a big difference for us, because you're right, we do, you know, we've played these songs about 6,000 times, so it's nice to keep them fresh as well.
It has to be a feeling of freshness for you in order to impart that to the audience.
It really does. But, you know, the great thing about playing live as much as we do, every night we step on stage, it's different. The people are different. They're laughing and crying, and they're remembering what was going on in their lives when they hear a particular song. So it's fresh for us, and we see their emotions bare. You know, they're crying and having all these emotions. So we see that, and that reflects upon us. So we deliver that song differently. Even though it's the same song, it's sung a little differently. And, you know, I may play a little different chord structure on any one song at any time, which keeps it fresh for us, you know.
It's difficult to remain unmoved when you're in the presence of people who are moved, right?
Oh, I couldn't agree more. Yeah, I mean, the thing with us, you know, with Air Supply, people either like our music or they don't, and that's okay, you know. But if people come to our show and they've never seen us before, even though they may like other kinds of music, something happens to them and they come back. And we talk to people after the show and we say, well, what brought you here? Or even during the show, say, what brought you here? Because I ask if anybody's been to see us before, and most people put their hands up. But for those that don't, I say, well, how did you come here? Did you get a free ticket? And they say, no, we've heard about this thing that happens at the show, and that we wanted to experience it, because something does happen. You know, it really does. Even on a small scale, something happens to them. And I think they see the passion, they see the reality of what we're doing, and they bathe in that. They absorb it, and because it's real, you know.
Graham Russell is half of Air Supply, which performs tonight at the Maui Arts and Cultural Center's Castle Theater. They'll be in Honolulu at the Neil Blaisdell Arena tomorrow night and at King Kamehameha's Kona Beach Hotel in Kailua Kona on Saturday. You can find out more on our Hawaii Facebook page.
I'm all out of love. I'm so lost without you. I know you were right. Believing for so long. I'm all out of love. What am I without you? I can't be too late to say that I want to go. I'm all out of love.
Well, now you have the opportunity to prove that you're not all out of love for Hawaii Public Radio. We're going to send it back to Pledge Central and see what's happening over there, where I understand we have a very large challenge on the table.